Hello, everybody. My name is David Jackson, and I am an alcoholic. I'm real honored to stand up here tonight and speak. You know, like Chris says, I'm fairly involved, and I love doing what I do. I've been given a job that I just absolutely love to do, and a boss that just loves me. I talk to my boss. My boss closes his conversation sometime on the phone with me and says, "I love you, David." And I say, "I love you back." And that ain't how my bosses used to talk to me. And I tell everybody in the world that I work for God, that my boss just signs his checks. And my boss says, "I know that, David. Has that check got enough zeros on it?" And it didn't used to be like that either. But I'm a 1955 model. And I was born on the high plains of Texas in a small town. And whenever I was 2 years old, my two older brothers were playing grab ass in the farmhouse, and one of them ran by the other one and grabbed this end of the bed, and it fell down on my legs and broke both my legs, and I was a miserable kid with two broke legs, so I was crying a lot, wanting my mom. Evidently, I don't remember it, but I do know that my two older brothers and my older sister later told me that they set fire to the house and tried to burn it down with me inside of it while my mom was hanging clothes out on the line. And so, you know, that kind of set the tone for the rest of my relationship with my family. And then when I was four, my mother died, and I became a ward of the state of Texas from the time I was four till the time I was 18. And I grew up in an orphanage. And, you know, there's just no other way to say this. And I know that my son is sitting over here tonight, and he's never heard me speak before, but yippee, guess what? Whenever I was 4 years old, there were two older kids out there that used to hold me down and rape me from the time I was four to the time I was six. And whenever I was 6 years old, that was the first time that I tried to kill a man. I stuck a butcher knife through one of them. And I didn't kill him. I mean, it's a crying shame because I was sure as hell trying to. And so later on, these powers that be, they wondered how come this little six-year-old comatose boy was so messed up. And so they moved me to another cottage, and I got introduced to this other fine Christian man. His name was, I'm not going to say his name. I'm just not. But he was convinced that I had the devil in me, and that he was going to beat the devil out of me. And he had a preferred method of... He had a boat oar that he had cut about that short and run a string through it, a leather tong, and he'd wrap it around his wrist right there and drilled holes in that boat oar and turn it up on its edge, and he could tomahawk with me, and he'd bring blood with it. And one time, I guess I was about 10 years old, and I had done something like, I had fallen asleep during the church service, and so he was having another go at me with this boat oar, and we'd been at it for a while, and I'd got loose, and I was jumped up onto his bed, and I was trying to get loose. And I made a feint for the door, and he went that way, and I jumped through the window, did a little tuck and run, And he had hit me on the ankle, and I was bleeding. He had hit me with that boat oar pretty good. I was bleeding on my ear. And I was getting tired of it. And so I jumped through this window, and I'm running down across the path. And there were some guys out there that this orphanage, and they were building a water fountain outside. And I ran by their place, and I grabbed up a brick. And this guy come charging out of the house chasing me. And I turned around, and I attacked him. I threw my legs around his waist and grabbed his shirt collar and come up with an overhead right with that brick in it. And I parted that crew cut that he had, and I thought I'd killed him. And it's a damn shame because I was trying to. But whenever you're about 10 or 12 years old and you've tried to kill two people, well, they treat you just a little differently. And they thought that I was crazy. And they wouldn't be too far from wrong. But they tried to put me in Gatesville over that. And Gatesville was a juvenile detention facility at the time. And they didn't succeed in doing that for a couple of reasons. And one of them is that I was just 12. I was not even a juvenile yet. And the other one was that the two bricklayers out there had witnessed this guy. And he told them that they both said that if you put this kid, if you do anything to this kid, we're going to tell everybody down there at that church that we seen. So they fired this guy, and he rode off, and his parting words were made that I was no good, that I had the devil in me, and that I was going to go straight to hell. And I believed him. That's what everybody else told me. Why should he be any different? Well, then I got introduced to this other fine Christian man. And he used the psychological approach when dealing with me. I was a problem child. I will admit that I had some issues. And this man's method of dealing with me was if I did something wrong, he would punish one of my friends or somebody in my family. And I had very few friends, if any. And I had found an old stray dog and I'd put a rope around her neck and I got an old hubcap and I put water in it for her. And I had me a pet. I had me a dog. And it was me and her. And we were best friends. Went everywhere together. And this fine Christian man, he walked outside one day and he asked me if this was my dog. And I said yes. And he took out a German Luger and he shot it right there while I watched. He told me that I was good enough to have a dog. And I'm still pissed off about that. I'm 62. That's been 50 years ago. But my dad, he came out to this orphanage to see me, and he asked me what was wrong. And I told him that. He shot my fucking dog, Dad. He shot my fucking dog. And my dad, he was a feeble man. He was sick. He couldn't take care of us kids. And he said, well, son, I don't know what to tell you. You're just going to have to grow up. And I was trying just as hard as I could to grow up. And then he got me a job that summer, he got me a job working off that orphanage. And I went to work in the oil patch. When I was 12 years old, I broke out in the oil patch. And and all that has something to do with this moment in time. I didn't fit in with my family. Didn't have any friends. I wasn't popular in school. I could barely read. I had been told by every adult that I knew that I was worthless, that I was ugly, and that I was going to go to hell. Bill calls it restless, irritable, and discontented in this book. And my oldest brother got a case of Coors beer, and I drank 5 cans of Coors beer sitting on a turn row. Y'all know what a turn row is?
Yeah.
You're a country girl, ain't you? I drank 5 cans of Coors beer sitting on a turn row up in Hockley County, Texas. And I went into a blackout. I pissed in my pants and I puked on my shirt and I said, "This shit is wonderful." And I come to the next day and I asked my brother, "Could we do that again?" And he said, "No." He said, "You have a problem." And I said, "Yeah, I know, I'm just 12. It's going to be 9 more years before I can buy any of it. What am I supposed to do?" And it wasn't till years later, I got sober and when I was 48. And in this book, it gives a description of the alcoholic. It doesn't tell us that we can pronounce anybody alcoholic, but he does tell us some pretty good information in here about what an alcoholic might look like. And I had this obsession to drink alcohol from a very young age. I thought that somehow, some way, I was going to be able to control the amount of alcohol that I drank. I'd seen other people drinking, and I would try to drink like them, but I never could. Because if I was controlling the amount that I took on, it wasn't enough. And I didn't enjoy it. And if I did start to enjoy it, I was drinking way too damn much of it. And it was causing problems in my life. And so I've got this mind that wants me to drink alcohol. But it gets better. You know, it gets worse, actually. It says, "We believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker." The only word that my sponsor will let me highlight in my big book is that word, "never," in that sentence. In my whole big book, that is the only word I get to highlight. Because he told me that whenever he seen me painting one up one time, and he said, "Oh, you think you know what that means, do you?" And I said, yeah. Somebody said something, I know what it means. And he said, "Give it about 3 or 4 years and it'll mean something else." So I'm not a big fan of marking up my book. I don't care if you do, but I don't. The only word that I get to mark up is that word "never." because it never occurs in the average temperate drinker. And whenever I would go to crayfishing about me being an alcoholic, whenever my sponsor would talk to me, and he would say, you know, that phenomenon of craving, that never occurs in normal people. And I'd say, yeah, but, and he'd say, yeah, but it never occurs in normal people. Never means never. And so, if you have had this thing called the phenomenon of craving, there's a good chance that you might be like me and be an alcoholic too. But then later on, it, you know, I had this mind that could make some shit up. Yeah. And it says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Duh. Yeah. Really. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. I couldn't tell myself the effect that alcohol was having on my life. I couldn't tell myself that my life was in the shithole because of my alcohol consumption, my drinking. And never mind the fact that I had 87 public intoxication charges against me in one county of Texas alone. I thought that, you know, the cops just didn't like me. And I was one of them alcoholics that could convince myself that if I put red Gatorade and rubbing alcohol, the Gatorade, the electrolytes and that stuff, would turn it into a health food drink and it would be good for me. Okay? And I told my sponsor about that. And by the way, my sponsor worked me right out of this big book. He set me down and he told me about some of his drinking and got me to open up about some of mine. And when I told him that, he said, well, David, why were you drinking rubbing alcohol? And I said, well, I wanted to feel better. And he said, well, did it ever work? And I said, no. Every time I drank rubbing alcohol, I got sick. He says, yeah, I kind of figured that. My sponsor then told me a story of his own. And he told me about in the early 60s, his wife had him admitted to the old Austin State Hospital. The one that looks like a spook house. That one that looks like a haunted house. And he was out there for about 30, 45 days, and then he said he finally figured out how to lift up a screen. He could get out on the roof and jump in this tree and crawl down that tree and go out and buy some wine. And they'd sit out there and drink wine till dawn and then climb back up the tree and get back in. And I said, well, Floyd, you know you was loose. Why did you go back in? And he said, well, I didn't want him to kick me out. Yeah. But that's the way that we think. There's something there that we can't differentiate the true from the false. And so I go through my life, I'm drinking, I'm drugging, I'm shooting up methamphetamine. I got busted with a buttload of it. and Judge Bob Perkins of the 331st District Court thought it would be a pretty good idea for me to go to treatment. And that's where I got introduced to AA. I remember Judge Perkins told me that he'd seen me plenty of times before, and he was tired of me. And he had finally caught me with something substantial. And he said that he was in a generous mood, that he was going to give me 3 years regular probation, or he was going to give me 10 years flat down at TDC. And my lawyer poked me and said, "Take the deal." And I said, "Well, what deal?" You know what? I'd seen a probation officer before. He wanted me to stop drinking, stop drinking, and give him a lot of money and get a job. And I he evidently didn't know who I was. Because that wasn't going to work. I went to a treatment center up in Waco, Texas, called the Freeman Center. And I got introduced to AA up there. And my very first meeting was a speaker meeting. And I was standing in front of the thing, and I was reading the steps for the first time. And it said, "We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable." And I thought, well, I'm quite sure I don't know what that means, so we won't be needing that one. And the second step says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I said, well, I'm not crazy. And then that third step said something about God, and I grabbed this counselor and I threw him up against the wall and I choked him down. And I said, "God, Bible camp, Bible camp, state of Texas wants to give me 10 years flat. You son of a bitches are sending me to Bible camp." Well, that ain't going to work. I need some real help here. And he's peeling my fingers off of his throat, and he says, "David, whenever you drink alcohol, can you stop drinking without running out of money, without going to the emergency room, going to the hospital, or going to the nut house?" And I had this moment. I said, "Well, no, I can't. No, I can't." And he said, "Well, thank you for sharing your first step with me." And I said, "I've already done a first step. I ain't been here for 2 hours, and I already did one of them." And in this book right here, on page 52, it tells me some things that really made sense to me when I sat down and I read this book with my sponsor. He said, we were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. I was always pissed off or depressed or angry, and just something was weird about me. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. It's hard to it's hard to be a good alcoholic and a good business executive. It really is. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we could see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. And he looked at me and he told me, any program that doesn't deal with these things is really not much of a program. And he told me that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is not a contest to see who can come in here and hold their breath and go without taking a drink of alcohol for the longest. That's pretty stupid. He says, we come in here and we deal with our stuff. And he told me that going to meetings and sitting in one of these chairs will no more keep you sober than sitting in your garage will turn you into a Chevrolet. Because it won't. I have to do some work. And he told me that my problem was just like this book says. On page 45. It says that lack of power, that was our dilemma. And a dilemma, for those people that don't know what that means, is where you've got two choices and both of them are bad. We had to find a power by which we could live. And it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? It says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Singular. There is no S on the end of that problem. That means that I've got one problem. And it's a whopper. I don't have any God in my life. I didn't want to hear that either. And so, the second step says that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. It's not a great theological debate on whether there is a God or whether there is not a God. It just says this is the solution. And I hear all people all the time say, well, I'm on step two. Do you know how to read? I mean, it's just a statement, you know. This is what the solution is. It tells you what the solution is. Are you like real stupid or something? You don't understand this language? And so the way that I find this power is working steps 3 through 9. And it's that simple. But I had to wrestle with God some more first. Because I wasn't entirely willing to give everything up. And what is this man's name? Steve?
Steve.
He read a while ago, he said, we got to let go absolutely. And absolutely means with everything. God don't want me to just let him have my alcohol problem. I'm a big fan of Joe and Charlie. And Charlie says, well, I was willing to let God have my alcohol problem, but you stay out of my sex life. You stay out of my pocketbook. That ain't how it works. He wants everything. You're not willing to do that? Go back and drink you some alcohol. Get ready. Get willing. I don't mean that, really. Please don't go drink alcohol. Come talk to me first. But my sponsor, when I finally got ready to work the steps, he set me down and and he worked me right out of the big book. There's a timeline in this book. And they used to work people through the steps really, really quick. And that's the way that my sponsor worked me through the steps. He set me down, and one day, you know, it only took me, after I got through wrestling with God, and I finally said, okay, I guess I'm just going to have to do a four-step. He set me down, and we worked steps 1, 2, 3, and 4 in one day. Yeah. It was so hard. I came back the next day. We did 5, 6, 7, and 8. It was terrible. And I came back that third day. We did a comprehensive plan on my 9th step. Means to start making some amends to some people. And he got me started doing 10, 11, and 12 on that third day. And he took me to Western Trails to the beginners meeting. And he said, you see that guy at the coffee pot? He has 2 days. I want you to go over there and talk to him. I said, what am I supposed to talk about? He said, why don't you tell him about some of your drinking? See if he can identify with it. See how he is? See how my sponsor does me? Because I'm reminded of Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson got struck sober in Towns Hospital in December of 1934. And for 6 months, he was running around New York City pulling drunks off bar stools, telling them that they needed to find God. They wanted to get sober. And at the end of 6 months, he had not succeeded in helping one single alcoholic get sober. And he's telling his wife about it, and Lois said, yeah, you've helped one person stay sober. You've helped your own, yourself. He says, well, why don't you go down and talk to Silkworth and see what he has to say about it? And Silkworth said, yeah, I've heard about some of your shenanigans. You're scaring these people off talking about God. And Bill said, well, what am I supposed to do? Just like I did. And Silkworth told him, said, well, why don't you tell them about some of your drinking and get them to identify with that? And then you can tell them what the solution is. And that's what I've been doing ever since then. I help people identify with the way that I drink and the way that I found God. And it's not hard. It's about as hard as you make it. And this power, you know, I find power in working the fourth step and doing the inventory. And I do a fifth step, and I tell my sponsors, I'm just lost the whole time that I'm working these steps. I'll read a step and go, well, what? Well, I ain't doing that. I don't know how to do it. I can't do that. And he'd say, well, I know that you're confused. He says, let me tell you about how I work these steps and what I found out. And then he'd tell me something about his drinking again and how he worked his fifth step. And then he'd get me to open up, and that fear would go away. And he said, do you remember anything that you did in the first grade? And I said, yeah, I do. And in the first grade, I was in love with this little girl named Patty Bentley. I was in love with her. She had a ponytail, cute little blue glasses, and crinkly nose, and smelled like bubble gum and ivory soap. I was in love with her. Boy, I was in love with her. And I had a burr haircut and big ears and a big nose, and if she would have said boo to me, I'd have fainted. But it was in that magic time of the year between Thanksgiving and Christmas in first grade, and there was these two little twin girls, and they were passing a note in class, and the teacher intercepted that note and opened it up and read it out loud to the rest of the class, and embarrassed the hell out of these two little girls, and marched them out in the hall and paddled their ass, and then marched them back in and told the rest of us, don't pass notes in my classroom. Well, I heard don't get caught passing notes in her classroom. And so we go out to recess, and the boys are over here playing grab ass or whatever we were doing, and the girls are over there doing whatever they are doing, and Patty Bentley comes up and starts talking to this guy named Dale Campbell. Oh, my God, I was so jealous. Dale had glasses, he had hair, you know, had a comb, you know, had a part. How could I compete with that guy, you know? My God. And to top it all off, he told Patty, "Get out of here, you dumb old girl. We're trying to play." There was a price that had to be paid. And I am steaming hot. And I go back into the classroom, and I get out my big chief writing tablet and my big best red Crayola, and I write on my thing in my best print, "Dear Patty, I love you, Dale." Folded it in two, waited for the teacher to walk by, and I sailed it up underneath her feet. She picked it up, read it out loud to the class, marched them out into the hall, paddled her ass. Yeah, 6 years up. And my sponsor asked me, he said, "David, was your self-esteem being affected?" And I said, Yeah, it was. He said, "How about your personal relationships? Was that being affected?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "How about your security instinct?" He said, "Well, I had a piece of paper and some red Crayola invested in this thing. And I was pretty hot. I was emotionally insecure." He said, "Well, how about your sex instinct?" And I said, "Well, I didn't know what that was, but I'm sure it was being affected." And it was affecting my ambitions with this young lady, too. And he said, "Well, David, were you being dishonest?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "Were you being selfish?" And I said, "Oh, yeah. He said, "Were you being self-seeking? Were you scheming to get your way?" "Yes, I was." He said, "Did you have any fear?" And I said, "Of course I did." And he said, "Were you being inconsiderate?" And I said, "Yes." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, David, were you drinking whiskey whenever you were 6 years old?" I said, "Hell no, it's going to be another 6 years before I drink." And he said, "See there? Alcohol ain't your problem." Been that way all my life, that big. So I found some power through talking about my shortcomings. And how I always, my default mode is to always misuse my God-given instincts for purposes that they were never designed for. God did never meant for me to use my security instinct, my social instinct, my sex instinct, or my ambition instinct to create huge resentments or to create huge fear. That is what I do. I misuse those God-given instincts. for purposes that were never designed for. No wonder my life was in the toilet. So I go through my life and I start working these steps and start to see how flawed I am. And I start leaving other people out of it. And I place my life on a service plane and I start making amends. And I always thought that, you know, hey, an amends is where you walk up to somebody and kind of say, hey, you know, I stole your air compressor. I'm kind of sorry about that. That's not what that is. If I take the Constitution of the United States of America down and I put an amendment on it, what have I done to that document? I have changed it. And that's what the word amend means, is change. And I go forth and I demonstrate to the people that I love the most that I have changed. And I find power in that. And three times in the time that I've been sober, I have told myself that I have completely finished my ninth step amends list. And three times I have been wrong. But the wonderful thing is I belong to this program that has steps 10, 11, and 12, where I can continue to take this inventory and look at my stuff and see where my shortcomings are glaring and how they always pop up. And on pages 85, 86, 87, and 88, it tells us how to pray and meditate. It tells us how to build some very specific prayers on page 85, 86, 87, and 88. Exactly what to do. And I sucked at it for a long, long time. Chris, how do you get good playing a guitar? You suck real bad at it first. Don't you? And that's the same thing about praying and meditating, is that you got to stay on it and you got to keep practicing. And my 12th step looks like a lot of things these days. I sponsor a lot of guys. I speak all over Texas, and I hope that I carry a message in such a simple, concise manner that it's not confusing to people, because I'm a country boy and I can complicate a paper sack. And you know, I get to do, whenever I place my life on a service plane where I'm here to serve God and my fellow man, magic happens, okay? Just straight up magic. I'm a miracle. The miracle is not in the fact that the steps of AA worked on me. The miracle of AA is the fact that the steps work on everybody that works them, okay? And there's nothing to figure out in this program. It's already been figured out. It's just a program of action. If you don't understand something, good. Just do it anyway. And I like to use the cake analogy a lot. And that is, if I decide to go down and get a cake, I want a cake. I go down to HEB and they've got hundreds of cakes. I say, I'm going to take this one right here. And on the back of that box, it has directions. It said, to cook this cake, you're going to need 3 eggs, 1/3 cup of oil, some water. And it tells me to preheat my oven, coat a pan with some flour, mix it with the eggs and the oil and water, and this mix, and mix it for 2 minutes on low speed and 2 minutes on high speed, and put it in the pan and bake it for 18 minutes, and I get a cake. I do not have to understand how the eggs and the oil and the water all chemically interchange to make this cake happen. I just know that if I follow the directions, I get the cake. You know, my life is not anything like it was whenever I was drinking and drugging. And, you know, my son is here tonight. He rode off into the sunset with his mother whenever he was about eight years old. And we reconnected this last week. He's a 30-year-old man now. And you know, that's one of those things that this program has given me, is the ability to face life on life's terms. I don't have to be a super dad or be a superstar. I'm quite content just being a worker bee among worker bees. I can't say enough about the things that this program has given me. It rains money on me. It just straight up rains money on me. Sometimes I'll look up and I have people just giving me checks. And I get to do cool stuff and go all over. And I help people. I'm that guy that, if you know somebody that doesn't have a penny to their name, call me. I can get them into a treatment center. I don't know why. I'm that guy that whenever they're just broke, I specialize in drunks with vomit still on their shoes. Them's my peeps. That's where I come from. I started a clubhouse down on 12th and Chicane here. We meet in an old bar down there right on the corner that used to be called Shorty's, with a brothel up top. Yeah. And who'd ever thought that? An old wet drunk like me would be able to do some things like that and have some people come out on Sunday night and listen to have anything I had to say and made any sense to you. Thank y'all for your time.